the headlines, Iran's president blames the new U.S. administration for continuing what he calls the terrorist acts of former President Donald Trump against Tehran. U.S. tech giant Google again targets Press TV, blocking the news outlet's YouTube accounts without prior notice. And also witnesses describe shock and frustration during day two of the trial of a white former officer over the murder of African-American George Floyd.
I identified myself right away because I noticed that he needed medical attention.
Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the new U.S. administration has failed to take practical steps to lift sanctions against his country. Rouhani said the Biden administration is following the lead of former President Donald Trump. Rouhani said Trump had committed an act of terror by slapping sanctions against the Iranian nation. He added the Trump administration was the most wicked one in U.S. history. Rouhani said Washington is seeking to create the impression that it's Tehran which is reluctant to cooperate when it comes to lifting the sanctions. The Iranian president said the new U.S. administration is also lying when it says it takes months for Washington to return to its commitments. He said it can be done in just one day. Rouhani reiterated Iran will fully live up to its obligations once the White House does so. U.S. tech giant Google has once again blocked Press TV's YouTube accounts. Google did so late on Tuesday without prior notice to the Iranian news channel. Google has cited violations of community guidelines for its move. This is the seventh time YouTube has targeted Press TV. The last time was just in September. Last week, Facebook also permanently shut down Press TV's page. The Iranian news outlet has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship on other social media platforms too, including Twitter and Instagram. Press TV says the moves are hostile and will not prevent it from telling the truth about world developments. The people in Bahrain have held anti-government protests calling for the immediate release of all political prisoners. Protesters demand that the Al Khalifa regime protect prisoners against the pandemic. The demonstrators also said the regime must stop arresting people for their beliefs. The protests were held in various regions. A popular uprising began in Bahrain in early 2011, calling for equality and democracy was suppressed by a heavy-handed crackdown that led to a large number of deaths and thousands of arrests. The crackdown has continued as people have time and again held rallies for pushing for their demands. A donors conference organized by the EU and UN raises 5.3 billion euros for those impacted by the Syrian conflict. Aid agencies say it's not enough as 24 million people are in need of urgent support. Press TV's Jerome Hughes reports.
More than 80 countries and international organizations took part in the fifth fundraising conference for Syria, coordinated from the European Commission in Brussels. Millions of Syrians displaced within their own country and millions more who fled face increasing hunger and poverty. Children have been very badly impacted during the 10-year conflict.
Tens of thousands of them have died. Almost half of all young people in Syria have lost an immediate family member or a close friend.
The US, UK and several EU nations have done all in their power to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Weapons supplied by the West to anti-government fighters were used to kill innocent civilians when these fighters joined Daesh. It's a point we raised with the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, during an online press conference.
Our Western nations not to blame to a large extent, or at least to some extent, for this catastrophe?
Borrell chose not to answer that question, so I asked if there's any justice in the EU donating 24 billion euro to Syria over the past 10 years, while donating 16 billion euro to Ukraine over a six-year period, perhaps because it has a border with the EU's adversary, Russia.
You cannot compare situation, a country destroyed by war and another country which is part of our neighborhood where there is a strong support for performing reforms.
For its part, the UK told the event it is planning to apply more pressure on the Syrian government.
So this month I announced new sanctions on six individuals who are responsible for the repressing of the civilian population in Syria.
It's being suggested the apparent obsession the UK, US and EU have with sanctions is making a horrific situation even worse. aid agency Oxfam says sanctions against the Syrian government are hampering efforts to provide humanitarian assistance within the country. Russia's Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister Sergei Vershinin told the conference that foreign interference in Syria must end in line with international law, and sanctions should be lifted from the Syrian government. Brussels would be wise to cooperate with Moscow, experts suggest.
It is indeed the time at least to reconsider their relationships with Russia because, first of all, of deep Russian involvement in the Syrian conflict and because of the global impact of its involvement in the whole region.
4 out of 5 Syrian refugees are trying to survive in neighbouring countries, not the EU, UK or US. The donors' conference raised €5.3 billion for 2021. Aid agencies are releasing statements saying it's simply not enough. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Witnesses have testified on the second day of the trial of Derek Chauvin. He's a former American white officer who killed unarmed black man George Floyd in Minneapolis last year.
I identified myself right away because I noticed that he needed medical attention. It didn't take me long to realize that he had an altered level of consciousness, and in our training, that is when the first sign that somebody needs medical attention. So my attention moved from Mr. Floyd to how can I gain access to this patient and give him medical attention or direct the officers.
In her testimony, the firefighter said she was concerned about Floyd's health. She said his face looked puffy and swollen. Meanwhile, lawyers for Chauvin argued that he followed his police training and was not guilty of the charges. During the arrest of George Floyd last May, Chauvin knelt on his neck for about 9 minutes before he lost consciousness and died. The incident, filmed by bystanders, rocked the United States and led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of African Americans. Colin Campbell says George Floyd's murder trial is a big case for all African Americans in the U.S.
Well, this really could be defined as, so far, the trial of the century. I know we don't have many big ones so far, but this one will stand for years to come. And that's because there's a lot at stake in this trial. When you look at the amount of evidence and the video evidence that was shown and what happened, the death of George Floyd, and, of course, the ramifications that have followed throughout 2020, we can really see that for particularly black Americans, black men, this is very much a big case. And so what we heard from today was the guy who practiced MMA, who was on the scene, talked about his experience in understanding different chokeholds and pressure points when trying to subdue an opponent, and how they were similar into what the police officer Derek Chauvin was using on George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And the other day I talked about that number, 9 minutes and 29 seconds. We had been saying 8 minutes and 46 seconds. If you remember, even in some of the protests and the chants, people talked about 8 minutes and 46 seconds was the amount of time that Chauvin had his knee on the back of George Floyd. But we know that it was actually a bit longer than that, almost 9 minutes and 30 seconds.
Child hunger in the United States has jumped by 50% during the COVID-19 pandemic. While a poor social safety net is getting most of the blame, increasing consumer prices are putting food off the tables for many low-income families. Romy Mazzari has more from Chicago.
Data from the United States Census has found that child hunger has soared 50% since the pandemic hit 1 year ago. Some of the biggest increases have been recorded in the nation's wealthiest communities, where the unprecedented demand for food aid has overwhelmed local authorities. The federal government has been consumed by political infighting, as Congress only recently passed just the second major household stimulus, despite the prolonged economic devastation wrought by lockdowns.
The people in the U.S. just make so little money, and food is becoming so expensive that, you know, people can't afford food. And this has increased since the COVID crisis. And And there's nothing in the U.S. Bill of Rights which says you are guaranteed a right to food. So the federal government really doesn't care.
The surge in hungry children is another reminder of the human toll caused by the infamously weak social safety net and the cutthroat capitalist culture of the world's richest country.
Meanwhile, you have farmers in Western states, since really the trade war with China started, that you've seen like mass quick slaughters of animals that were for meat because they couldn't make a profit because they can't ship to China. Since the pandemic started, you've had videos of like farmers having to light their potato crops on fire. So there's enough food in the U.S. It's just the system's not set up to get it to people.
The lockdowns have caused supply chain disruptions in food production, leading to increased food prices, which show no sign of lowering. While corporations can sometimes navigate disruptions, small grocers and corner stores, which are usually the only place to buy food in poor American neighborhoods, are forced to pass higher costs onto their customers, usually low-wage workers who are least able to afford price increases. In February, the UN's food price index rose for the 9th consecutive month, reaching a level not seen since 2014, a year that saw major food riots in multiple developing countries. It's not just food prices which have inflated out of the reach of many recently. Gasoline prices are at their highest point in 6 years, up over 40% in the past 12 months. Home prices are soaring faster than in almost a decade, up 11% over the past year. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Well, Brazil sets a new record in its coronavirus fatalities as the pandemic shows no sign of abating in the Latin American country. Brazil registered nearly 3,800 daily COVID-19 deaths and almost 85,000 new infections. The government has come under fire for its handling of the crisis. Vaccination has also been sluggish there, with fewer than 7% of the people having received a jab. Brazil is the second worst hit country by the pandemic after the United States. Fatalities in the U.S. have surpassed 550,000, and infections stand at over 30.3 million. Ukraine's daily tally of COVID deaths has hit a record high of 407. The health ministry also reported more than 11,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. Ukraine's total COVID infections are now above 1.6 million, with nearly 33,000 deaths. Daily cases and fatalities have recently spiked there, prompting the tightening of restrictions. In Germany, COVID cases rose by over 17,000 to more than 2.8 million. Its total death toll has topped 76,000. Several European countries have seen record jumps in their daily cases and deaths. That's blamed on a sluggish vaccination program and new variants, among other things. Well, the U.S. and more than a dozen of its allies have criticized a recent report by World Health Organization investigators about the origins of COVID-19. A U.S. statement said the probe lacked the data and samples it needed, and the investigations did not have full access to them. The statement called for transparent and independent analysis. WHO chief made similar criticism. The team conducted its probe earlier this year in the Chinese city of Wuhan. That's where the coronavirus pandemic began. The probe concluded that the virus probably came to humans from animals, not from a lab. China says it has demonstrated its openness and that the issue must not be politicized. India has reported the highest number of COVID-19 cases in 5 months. Many fear the second wave is imminent and would put the whole nation at risk. As Munawar Zaman reports, the country has crossed the 12 million mark, making India the third hardest hit after the United States and Brazil.
The COVID-19 pandemic is once again worsening in India after a huge surge on Tuesday. The country reported more than 56,000 fresh cases and 270 deaths in the last 24 hours. This is the highest single-day spike since October last year. Authorities in state of Maharashtra have reimposed strict travel ban and nighttime curfews to prevent the further spread of the disease. Other states such as Punjab, Gujarat, Tamil Nadu, Haryana and Madhya Pradesh are the worst affected. Health experts have warned about unchecked gatherings. They say the situation can be controlled if more people are vaccinated in a robust way and the COVID-19 protocols are strictly enforced and followed in spirit. With a population of more than 1.3 billion, India's mammoth task of vaccinating its population is going on in full swing. At Rajiv Gandhi Hospital on the fringes of New Delhi, hundreds queue up to get their first shot every day. Coordinators say while many are now flocking in huge number, skepticism still remains for many about the possible side effects of the vaccine.
In India, the vaccine hesitancy was there. And now, once the people are realizing that Covaxin or Covishield, both vaccines are really not having any major side effect. So that has given confidence to the majority of the general population, and now they are really coming forward.
Since early October last year, India witnessed a consistent decline in the number of cases, raising hopes that the pandemic is retreating and over. Prime Minister Modi has called for decisive steps to halt the emergence of the second wave.
There may be little laxity in the behavior of the people. That is why the infections is being seen in majority of the people, particularly in Maharashtra.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism for the slow pace of the vaccination rollout. Health experts, however, say people are not taking the issue seriously and ignoring government calls for vaccination. Authorities have already expanded the vaccination program to reach a target of 300 million by July. However, fears have grown since last week about the second possible wave, which many say could be dangerous. Munawar Zaman, Press TV, New Delhi.
Pakistan's prime minister has sacked the country's finance minister over his failure to control inflation. Imran Khan also decided to bring a major reshuffle in his cabinet as the government is struggling to revive the economy. Press TV's Kamran Yusuf has the details from Islamabad.
Across the board, unka ek spectrum hai.
This is the third finance minister appointed by Prime Minister Imran Khan in the last 2.5 years. Hamad Azhar, the Minister for Industries, has been appointed as the new finance minister after incumbent Hafiz Sheikh was sacked by the Prime Minister. Sheikh, who has a vast experience of working with international financial institutions and even previously served as finance minister, has been blamed for failing to control the inflation.
Prime Minister Imran Khan has reviewed the government's 2.5 years' performance, and the government is looking to change its economic strategy. That is why the Prime Minister is now bringing a new economic team.
Pakistan's economy has been struggling since Prime Minister Khan took charge in August 2018. Last year, the country reported a negative economic growth, while the forecast for the current fiscal year does not look promising either. The sluggish economic growth has led to the unprecedented inflation, causing problems for the common man.
The inflation is really making our life difficult. There is a price hike in everything. Sacking the finance minister will not bring relief to the people. The government needs to change its policies.
Sir, relief, jo hai na, sir. Government needs to take steps to lower the prices of daily use items. This is the only demand of common people.
The sacked finance minister could not win the Senate election earlier this month when his own party lawmakers voted against him. Opposition parties, which are seeking the ouster of Prime Minister Khan, describe as their victory the removal of the finance minister.
We have been repeatedly told that inflation is being brought under control, the economy is growing, and all economic indicators are positive. But now the finance minister has been sacked for failing to control the inflation. This is our vindication.
Imran Khan has promised to bring economic and other reforms, but observers believe that his government has so far failed to live up to the expectations.
With growing public and opposition pressure, Prime Minister Khan is bringing a new economic team to control the inflation and revive the economy. He has also decided to reshuffle his cabinet, but it remains to be seen if all these changes will improve the government's performance. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Let's wrap it up.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to a new report released recently by consumer advocacy group Public Citizen, Facebook and Amazon spent more money on federal lobbying than any other U.S. corporations during the 2020 election cycle, with Comcast not far behind in third place. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Fending Off Antitrust Push, Tech Giants Now Biggest Spenders on DC Lobbying. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. With Facebook and Amazon leading the charge, Big Tech has surpassed Big Oil and Big Tobacco to become the largest lobbying spender in the U.S. as the increasingly powerful and consolidated industry attempts to use its wealth to fend off growing support for antitrust action among lawmakers and the American public. According to a new report released recently by consumer advocacy group Public Citizen, Facebook and Amazon spent more money on federal lobbying than any other U.S. corporations during the 2020 election cycle, with Comcast not far behind in third place. Using campaign finance data from the Center for Responsive Politics, the report shows that big tech companies have donated to 94% of the members of Congress who serve on the House and Senate committees with jurisdiction over the industry. Notably, contributions are not skewed too heavily to one side of the aisle, Public Citizen notes. Democrats, in sum, received $1.7 million in 2020, while Republicans received $1.4 million. Overall, the group found tech giants spent $124 million on lobbying and campaign contributions during the 2020 cycle, shattering its previous spending records. Amazon and Facebook drew most of this growth, Public Citizen points out, with Amazon ramping up spending by 30% and Facebook by 56%. The two companies spent nearly twice as much as Exxon and Philip Morris on lobbying during the 2020 campaign, the analysis finds. In this moment of enhanced security, tech companies are going to spend millions and dial through their Rodok says, looking for officials to stop regulation and legislation needed to protect consumers, said Lisa Gilbert, Public Citizen's executive vice president. She added, that is simply unacceptable. In addition to significantly increasing their spending, Facebook, Amazon, Google, and Apple also added dozens of lobbyists to their teams of influence peddlers in Washington, D.C., according to Public Citizen. The The four big tech companies recruited more lobbyists into their army, increasing its ranks by 40 new lobbyists, from 293 in 2018 to 333 in 2020, the new report notes. Big tech's lobbyists are not just numerous, they're also among the most influential in Washington. Among the 10 lobbyists who were the biggest contributors to the 2020 election cycle, half lobby on behalf of at least one of the four big tech companies. Big tech's growing lobbying operation in the nation's capital is reaching its zenith as industry titans Facebook and Google are attempting to quash antitrust lawsuits led by the U.S. Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, and state attorneys general. On top of the ongoing legal challenges to tech giants' market dominance, both Democratic and Republican lawmakers expressed support last month for legislative action, including potentially breaking up huge companies to curtail the power of corporations like Facebook, Google, and Amazon, leaving antitrust advocates hopeful that meaningful change could be on the horizon. We need to rein in big tech's influence in Washington now so that lawmakers and regulators can break them up, enact comprehensive privacy legislation, and hold these companies accountable for harming the economy and democracy. Jane Chung, big tech accountability advocate for Public Citizen, said in a statement recently, "The Federal Trade Commission, the Justice Department, and state attorneys general are signaling that justice is finally on its way," added Chung. "But with big tech political expenditures at historic levels, it's more important than ever for lawmakers to show their independence and bring these companies to heel."
The debate.
Hi, everybody. A warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Now, based on Politico, an American political journalism company, the U.S. is going to offer a new plan to encourage Iran to go back to the negotiating table. Of course, that would require Tehran to stop part of its nuclear activities and return for some relief from Washington's unilateral sanctions. An Iranian informed source told Press TV on Monday that Tehran is not going to accept the new proposal that Washington is set to be preparing to put forth soon. Tehran saying for the nuclear deal to be revived, Washington only needs to make a political decision. It doesn't have to come up with any new plans.
A senior Iranian official said that Tehran will stop its 20% uranium enrichment only if the U.S. lifts all its sanctions on the Islamic Republic first. The official said Tehran will further reduce its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal if the U.S. does not end all sanctions, warning that Washington is rapidly running out of time. The remarks are in response to a report published in Politico that said Washington is to offer a new proposal to Tehran to jumpstart the talks on the nuclear deal as soon as this week. This comes as the Iranian president has already rejected the notion of talks on the nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani said, since Washington did not sit for talks when it left the deal, its return to the agreement also merits no negotiations, but a mere political will.
The proposal asks Iran to halt some of its nuclear activities, such as work on advanced centrifuges and the enrichment of uranium to 20% purity in exchange for some relief from U.S. economic sanctions.
After a year of full compliance with the agreement following U.S. withdrawal, Iran gradually started to scale down its nuclear deal commitments because the European parties to the accord, under pressure from the U.S., failed to meet their obligations. Iran says its countermeasures conform to the terms of the deal that allows one side to reduce commitments when others do not honor theirs. Since taking office, U.S. President Joe Biden has followed his predecessor Donald Trump's policies vis-a-vis the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Experts believe U.S. policies toward Iran have always been hostile, irrespective of who is in charge of the White House.
The U.S. is determined to overthrow the Iranian government, but it cannot overthrow the Iranian government. And so here we have a situation where the U.S. policy can't really succeed, and the U.S. politicians won't back away from a consensus position that exists within the American establishment.
The Biden team has repeatedly said Washington is open to talks with Tehran, stressing that the ball is in Iran's court to revive the accord. Washington says Iran must first return to full compliance and the U.S. would then rejoin the accord. Iran has, however, rejected the U.S. position, stressing that Washington must take the first step and lift all sanctions because it was the U.S. that left the agreement in the first place. The Iranian president maintained that the remarks by Iran's leader make it very clear that Tehran would fulfill all its commitments if and only if the U.S. returns to its obligations under the deal.
All right, Dad, with that report, let's get down to business. So joining me in the debate will be from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker out of San Francisco. And also we'll have author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman joining us out of Washington, D.C. Good to have both of you gentlemen on the show. Let's go to Richard. Americans have told Politico that all they are trying to do is to get the conversation started between the U.S. and Iran. Now, reacting to that report, an Iran-informed source told Press TV that what the U.S. needs to do was just to undo the sanctions. They don't need to take the trouble and come up with new plans. Isn't that right?
Well, I think so. The present existing administration is an extension of the United States government and the United States government that under Trump drew, and I think drew illegally from this agreement. It was an act of great irresponsibility, with the idea coming from Trump and his advisors that this would lead to the downfall of the Iranian government, which of course it hasn't. It has not achieved anything of what the United States government is trying to do, except, and I think this is a big except to really cause more suffering among the Iranian people. The idea of these sanctions, whether the sanctions against Iran or Iraq, which I witnessed personally, or Cuba, which I have witnessed personally the effects of, or against Venezuela, all these sanctions against North Korea, many other countries, are meant to cause those countries to become weaker. The idea that they lead to the overthrow of the governments is just ridiculous. But they do cause great, great suffering among the people. Really, I believe that sanctions should be, these kind of economic sanctions should be considered to be crimes against humanity. But it's certainly the responsibility of the United States government to return to the position that was adopted under the JCPOA, and that called for the lifting of sanctions, U.S. and U.N. sanctions against Iran.
Now, Michael, the new proposal wants Iran to stop part of its nuclear activities, like working advanced centrifuges and also uranium enrichment to 20% purity, and that in exchange for some relief from U.S. sanctions. Now, ranking official told Press TV that Tehran is not going to accept that offer. Iran has clearly asserted its stance, and that is verifiable lifting of all the U.S. sanctions before anything else. Let's have your comments on that.
Well, my comments are basically that the introductory report pretty much said everything except the fact that you can use the old saying, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. The Iranians have seen what the Americans have said and what the Americans have actually done, and they've seen that the sanctions have not been lifted despite change of administrations. What's not been said is the controls and the connections that the apartheid entity that styles itself Israel is deeply involved with both the Trump and the Biden administrations. Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. has children married to Jews. His Secretary of State is a Jew. The Deputy Secretary of State is a Jew. The Deputy Secretary and Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency is a Jew. And the Director of National Intelligence is a Jew. And as Jonathan Pollard said recently, Jews have one loyalty to Israel, no other country whatsoever. So I think that what we've got is a continuation of Israel's policy to try and destroy Iran. The Israelis don't like to have Iran to have any kind of long-range missiles. They object to Iranians question this constant inspection of the country on a surprise basis, which is going to expire at the end of May. The Biden administration claims it doesn't want to do anything at all about making the first step in renegotiating or bringing about a reinstitution of the JCPOA because it might offend some Republicans in Congress. And all of this is nonsense. And the basics of it, of course, are that there is no JCPOA aimed at Israel, which has an uncounted number of nuclear weapons, an uncounted amount of poison gas, and an uncounted amount of deadly bacteria. Everything is aimed at Iran. Everything is discussed about Iran. But Israel and Saudi Arabia and India and Pakistan, for example, are not involved in any of this. The British are expanding their nuclear warfare capabilities with new submarines. And nobody says a word about that, but it's always Iran, Iran, Iran. And as the Germans say, Quatsch, which is a very strongly worded expression for stuff and nonsense that borders on the vulgar.
Okay. Now let's go to San Francisco to Richard. Iran's UN ambassador has also echoed the same reaction by saying that in order for the U.S. to return to the JCPOA, nothing is needed but the White House's political decision to fulfill its commitments under the deal it wants to, let's say, revive. Now, do you think the U.S. will return to the deal and will comply with its commitments, or has Biden already chosen an arm-twisting approach towards Tehran?
Well, let me first of all say, and I must say this, is that I do not agree in any way, shape, or form with the idea that Israel is dictating U.S. foreign policy, or that because of the religion of certain top officials in the U.S. government, that this is what's directing U.S. policy. I think that's a really anti-Semitic line. And I think it's one that it really does great disservice to those of us who, and progressive people everywhere who are calling for an end to the U.S. policy against Iran. The U.S. is the most far-flung empire that's ever existed. It has bases, more than 800 bases all over the world. No country has ever had before. And the idea that that a small country, a relatively small but militarily powerful because the U.S. has built up Israel, and that is the reason that the U.S. supports Israel, because Israel is really part of the U.S. war machine. It's not because of Jewish people or sympathy for Jewish people or anything like that. Whether or not this is going to continue with the Biden administration going forward with its policy, apparently going forward with the policy of seeking more concessions from Iran before agreeing to return to the conditions of the JCPOA. And I must say, the conditions of the JCPOA were quite onerous for Iran. It's not like it was some great victories, you know, or Iran got all the good things from it. No, it's not. It was a compromise that was very seriously debated inside the Iranian parliament and the Iranian political establishment as a whole. So the idea that Iran should have to make more concessions, should have to do something else before the U.S. would agree to return to the JCPOA and to lift the sanctions is really a step way too far to expect from Iran. And also, we know that the Iranian presidential election is coming up. I believe it's coming up in June. And that of course, affects the position of...
Yeah, I'm going to ask about it, too, yeah. Okay, let's go back to D.C. Michael, Joe Biden kept lashing out at Donald Trump for pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal during his presidential campaign, but Biden has done nothing practically to revive the deal 2 months into his administration. How do you explain this inconsistency and contradiction?
Well, basically because he says he's a proud supporter of Israel. And of course, Israel is America's oldest enemy and greatest debtor. They control the state governments in the United States to the extent that 26 of them have passed resolutions and laws against boycott, divestment, and sanction. They even control high school and college textbook content in the United States. So Biden, with his Zionist relatives and with his strong support of Israel, which he's announced over the years, is the main reason behind this. I think any criticism of Israel is automatically branded as anti-Semitic, which frankly, I gotta say, is kvat again. So I think that Biden will not take any kind of steps throughout his administration because of his strong support of Israel and its illegitimacy and its murder, war crimes, and human rights violations. So I think that Biden has got to change his mind, if he has a mind, given some of the things he's done and said recently. So I think that we've got to get rid of Biden. We've got to get rid of half his administration, which are retreads from Clinton and the Obama administrations. And we've got to get some people in there who know what they're doing, who understand the real world, and who are not beholden to any foreign entity.
Okay. Now, let me ask Richard Becker. Richard, as you know, Tehran recently signed this 3-month agreement with the IAEA, and that will expire in late May. And Iran regards this deal as a window of opportunity for U.S. and also European signatories to the JCPOA to take this opportunity and do what's necessary to do regarding the deal, if they really want to revive it as they claim it. Would they benefit from this chance and really take some action and do something in order to see this thing rolling again?
Well, I think that if they don't, take some real action, that the United States will become more and more isolated here. We know that the China and Iran just signed a long-term strategic agreement for development, for trade, and so forth. And while the United States is still the dominant military power in the world, and as I said, has bases all over the world, military bases, which are generally unwelcome by people who live around them. It's not a pleasant experience to live right by a military base with all the training and so forth. And it's an infringement on the sovereignty of so many different countries. Well, while that's going on, you have China going forward with making agreements with many countries for actual development projects for maybe as many or more countries now, including Iran. So you can see the United States, and I think this poses a particular danger, I have to say this, is that the U.S. is becoming more isolated and weakened internationally, except in the area of, and maybe not even to say except, but its main strength is the military strength. And that means that because the determination of U.S. leaders is to maintain global domination, to be the dominant power in the world, according to the national security strategy, that the threat of war is a very real threat against Iran, against China, against Russia. And so we have to look at that. But if the U.S., if its U.S. allies don't take some real action like they pledged to when the JCPOA was reneged on by the United States, then they too will have forfeited an opportunity to put an end to this situation that exists now in regard to Iran. Mm-hmm.
Now, Michael, as for Iran's remedial measures, you know that they started a year after former President Trump pulled his country out of the JCPOA. And what Iran has done has been based on paragraph 36 of the nuclear deal. Now, those measures can all stop immediately, provided the U.S. lifts the sanctions. Now, anything ambiguous about this?
Not at all. It's very, very clear. It was quite clear that the United States broke the agreement, and it says in the agreement that if one country breaks it, the other countries are not bound by it. And the Iranians have repeatedly said, after a year of waiting and waiting and waiting for American non-action, to say that, okay, we will take steps that were enjoined under the original agreement, and when you when we progressively do this, we will enrich more and more uranium, we will have more and more heavy water, and when the Americans, with the stroke of a pen, abolished the sanctions illegally applied, and applied as a punitive, vicious attempt to destroy Iran and its people, the Iranians have said, fine, we'll take step after step until the Americans take the first step towards abolishing its failure to abide by the treaty. If the Americans rejoin the treaty, if the Americans drop all of the sanctions, we will then quite easily and quite simply, with the stroke of a pen from our side, start doing something about the centrifuges and shipping out enriched uranium and heavy water amounts in excess of the treaty. And we will go back to observing it as long as America and the Europeans, the Germans and the French and the British and the Russians and the Chinese, who have the latter two, of course, have criticized American inaction. And they've criticized, as many people have, the Europeans' refusal to abide by the agreement. They have supported removing their companies from Iran. They have refused to provide compensation for that, as they promised to do. They came up with a really bad organization, an agreement called INSTEC, which is supposed to provide for essentially barter between different currencies for things Iran needs and Europe needs from Iran. But they do nothing with that except talk about it more than anything else. So that's it. Pretty much, if the Americans observe the agreement, the Iranians will observe the agreement. Okay. That's very simple, very straightforward, and even enough for Joe Biden and his diminished mental capacity to handle.
Okay, Richard, I got one quick question. Iranian parliament has compelled the Rouhani administration to stop waiting for the other parties to deal to fulfill their commitments. MPs want the administration to keep scaling back on Iran's commitment within the JCPOA. Also, we have the presidential election, and you mentioned in a couple of months. How would you foresee the state of affairs as regards the nuclear deal? We have only 1 minute left.
Well, I think that there has to be a decision made in the current regime in the United States, the current administration, about whether they want to go forward with becoming more and more isolated, or whether they want to return to the JCPOA without conditions that they're trying to impose on Iran. That's what would be the correct and just way to go forward. Whether or not that's going to happen, given the neocon nature of the foreign policy group that's now leading foreign policy on behalf of the administration, I think is really in doubt.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this debate show on Press TV. Let me thank our guests. We had from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker out of San Francisco, and also we had author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, who joined us out of Washington, D.C.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I told Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. What are our primary needs as human beings? Things that will keep us alive, of course. Those are the primary needs. Without them, we will cease to exist. And that is pretty much, number one, our food, number two, our water, eating and drinking, and number three would be reproduction. And of course, reproduction for the sake of bringing about a next generation, not for the sake of him or her, their life being dependent on reproduction, no. But for the sake of having a next generation, reproduction is also a primary need. And there are secondary needs. These secondary needs are things that you need to have, but if you don't have them, or if you don't have them in certain ways, then it won't be the end of your life, literally saying. And then, of course, there are the pseudo-needs, which are things that you know you think you need, but in reality, you don't. When it comes to something like a necessary need, a primary need that we would also need to have as human beings, is the need for shelter. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, and there are numerous ahadith that pretty much use foundations of sa'adatul mar, of the happiness of a man, the happiness of a person, and but just rephrase it in different ways. Min sa'adatul mar, from among the happiness, or that which will generate happiness for a man, is al mar'atu saliha, a righteous wife, wal maskanul wasi', and a wide, large house. وَالْمَرْكَبُ الْبَهِي, and a fast, comfortable kind of mountable animal. وَالْوَلَدُ الصَّالِحِ, and a righteous child. And there's another hadith that also mentions pretty much the same thing. ثَلَاثَةٌ مِنْ نِعَمِ الدُّنْيَا وَإِنْ كَانَ لَا نَعِيمَ لَهَا. That's which is a beautiful expression as well. Also from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. And this pretty much says that there are three things that are from among the blessings of dunya, even though this dunya doesn't have much of blessings to give. Markabun watiyun, a good mounting animal, like an animal that you're able to use for transport, a horse, a camel. Wal maratu saliha, and a righteous wife. Wal manzilul wasi'. So this whole emphasis on having a al darul wasi', al manzilul wasi', maskanul wasi', is pretty much for a person to be able to feel that level of comfort in their house. They're able to do things as they wish inside of their house, and everything else, because ultimately a house will bring about a level of honor for you as a human being. You know, in your social presence, you know, you want to invite people, you want to be proactive in the community, you want to have programs in your house, you want to accommodate to other people. All of these things need al-dar al-wasa, need a large house.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Here it's also interesting for us to remember the sunnah that we see, which people usually practice among Muslim communities, and that is when you do purchase a house, when you do build a house, that you offer a sacrifice. And that sacrifice in the form of an animal is something that is given as a way of expressing your gratitude to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as repelling evil eye and envy, as a way of you knowing that this is going to be something that you will use for good, positive usages. Here the hadith says, also from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, "Man bana manzilan falyadhbah kabsha." Someone who builds, whoever builds a house, they should slaughter a sheep. And then he says, "Walyut'im lahmahu al-masakin," and you should feed the meat of this slaughtered, sacrificed sheep to the poor, to poor people. Now, continuing on with some of the good things that, of course, a house is going to have, is you need to be a good neighbor, and you need to have good neighbors. Sometimes our central kind of focus is on hoping that we have good neighbors, that our neighbors turn out to be good people. What about us? How about me, myself? Am I a good neighbor? Am I observing haqqul jar, the right of my neighbor? Am I trying to be as courteous as possible? You know, sometimes people say, well, it's Saturday night and legally you're allowed to make noise after midnight and whatnot, all these other things that sometimes some people might say. But that's far from haqqul jar from an Islamic perspective. If you are annoying them, if you are disrupting their peace that they are more than entitled to, although legally you might not be doing something illegal. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic.